Hey everyone, welcome to another deep dive. This time we're taking a look at a Supreme Court case that might sound a little dry at first, but trust me, it gets really interesting. We're talking about Department of Revenue of Kentucky v. Davis, and this case dives into some big questions about taxes, bonds, and whether states can actually play favorites when it comes to how they raise money.
Yeah, this case really gets into the nuts and bolts of how states fund all those big projects that we all rely on, you know, like roads, bridges, schools, all that good stuff. And at its heart, it raises these really tricky questions about whether states can give their own residents a leg up when it comes to investing in those very same projects.
Okay, so let's set the stage here. What exactly was going on in Kentucky that led to this case in the first place?
Well, Kentucky wanted to make its bonds more attractive to investors. You know, they wanted to keep those borrowing costs nice and low. So they came up with this idea to make the interest earned on Kentucky bonds tax-free, but only for Kentucky residents. Sounds like a pretty sweet deal if you live in Kentucky, right?
Right, but there's got to be a catch.
Oh, there's definitely a catch. People living in other states still had to pay taxes on those Kentucky bonds.
Ah, so that's where our plaintiffs, the Davis's Kentucky couple, stepped in. They're basically saying, hold on a minute, that doesn't seem fair.
Exactly. They were hit with state income tax on interest they earned from bonds issued by other states, so they cried foul. They argued that Kentucky's system was straight up discrimination against interstate commerce, and that's where this thing called the Dormant Commerce Clause enters the picture.
Okay, so we've got this seemingly simple tax break on bonds, and all of a sudden we're talking about the Constitution and interstate commerce. Can you break down this Dormant Commerce Clause for us? What makes it such a big deal when states interfere with interstate commerce?
Imagine a world where each state was just playing favorites all the time, you know, giving special treatment to their own products, their own services. We wouldn't really have a national economy at that point, would we? It would be like a bunch of little mini economies all walled off from each other. The Dormant Commerce Clause is there to prevent that kind of fragmentation. It's there to make sure everyone's playing by the same rules, that there's a level playing field for businesses and consumers no matter where they are in the U.S.
So the Davises are basically saying, hey, Kentucky, you can't give your bonds this special advantage just because you're the one who issued them.
Right. It sounds like they were concerned that if every state started doing this, the whole bond market would just turn into a chaotic free-for-all.
That's exactly one of the concerns that the dissenting justices brought up in this case. They were worried about what they called a race to the bottom. Imagine a world where investors are only buying bonds from their own state just to dodge those taxes. It could really mess up the national bond market and might even lead to higher borrowing costs for states in the long run. Okay, so on one side, we've got the Davises, who are saying that Kentucky's tax scheme is unfair and could really hurt the national bond market.
Yeah.
What was Kentucky's defense? How did they try to justify this system?
Kentucky's main argument was that when states issue bonds, they're not acting like regulators, they're acting as market participants. And as participants, they argued they should have a little more wiggle room to look out for their own interests.
Market participants. It sounds like that idea was pretty central to Kentucky's case. But isn't Kentucky still a state even when they're issuing bonds? How do we draw that line between market participant and, you know, state regulator?
That's the million-dollar question, and it's one that the dissenting justices really struggled with. They argued that Kentucky was definitely overstepping its bounds, that they were essentially using their power to tax as a weapon to get ahead in the bond market, and that's a big no-no under the Dormant Commerce Clause. So it really becomes this clash of legal philosophies. On one hand, you've got the majority taking this more hands-off approach to state economic activity, and on the other hand, you've got the dissent pushing for a much stricter interpretation of the Dormant Commerce Clause.
It's getting juicy. So we've got this really interesting tension between the power of the states and the oversight of the federal government. And the Supreme Court's got to figure out where to draw that line. But before we reveal their decision, let's unpack that market participant idea a little bit more. It sounds like Kentucky's entire case hinges on that very concept.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. To really understand how the majority came to their decision, we need to understand what's called the market participant exception. Basically, it says that when a state is acting like a business, you know, buying and selling stuff, it's not held to the same strict standards under the Dormant Commerce Clause. It's like the state's taking off its regulator hat and stepping onto the playing field to compete with private companies.
Got it. But how does that apply to this whole Kentucky bond scheme? It's not like the state's out there selling shoes or gadgets.
The majority argued that when Kentucky issues bonds, it is engaging in a market transaction. They're selling something, a financial product, a promise to repay borrowed money with interest, and they're doing it just like a private company might issue corporate bonds. So in that context, the state should be allowed to use the same tools as any other company to attract investors, and that includes things like tax incentives.
So the court is essentially saying that even though Kentucky is a state, when they put on their bond issuer hat, they can act more like a private entity. Interesting. But I can already see how the dissenting justices might not be too happy about that logic, especially when it comes to something as big and impactful as the bond market. But before we get into their arguments, I think it's important to make sure everyone listening understands why this whole case even matters to them.
Absolutely. This isn't just some legal debate happening in a vacuum. This case, Kentucky v. Davis, has very real consequences for anyone who invests in bonds, or even anyone who just cares about how their state raises money for these big public projects. The court's decision basically gives states more freedom to use tax incentives to attract investors to their bonds, and that could have a ripple effect throughout the entire bond market.
So it's not just about whether Kentucky can give its own residents a tax break.
Mm-hmm.
This case could potentially affect your own pocketbook if you're an investor. What kind of impact should listeners be aware of?
Put yourself in the shoes of someone holding bonds from another state. Now imagine your state decides to follow Kentucky's lead and offers a tax break, but only on their own bonds. You're suddenly stuck paying more in taxes. It could also make it tougher for states that don't offer these tax breaks to attract investors, which means they might have to pay higher borrowing costs. And guess who ends up footing that bill? The taxpayers.
Wow. So there are some potentially big economic consequences here. This case starts to feel a lot less theoretical when you put it like that. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Before we delve into the dissenting opinions and all the potential impacts, let's rewind and go back to the Supreme Court's decision. What did they decide? Did they side with the Davises and put a stop to Kentucky's tax scheme?
Well, this is where things take a really interesting turn. In a bit of a twist, the court actually sided with Kentucky. They decided that Kentucky's tax scheme didn't violate the Dormant Commerce Clause and their reasoning. Well, it all boils down to that whole market participant argument we were just talking about. The court basically said that when states are issuing bonds, they're acting more like players in the game rather than referees, and as players, they should have some leeway to favor their own interests.
Okay, so Kentucky wins this round.
Hmm.
But I'm guessing the dissenting justices weren't exactly thrilled with this outcome. What were their main concerns about the majority's decision?
You're right, they weren't thrilled. Justices Kennedy and Alito were particularly outspoken in their dissent. Justice Kennedy argued that this whole decision could really open the floodgates to a lot of economic protectionism. He was worried that if other states followed Kentucky's lead, it could create a very chaotic and fragmented national market. It's that whole race to the bottom idea we talked about earlier, where everyone's trying to undercut each other, and ultimately the whole market suffers.
That does sound pretty messy. Did the dissenting justices offer any alternative approaches? How did they think the court should have handled this case?
Justice Alito had a real problem with the whole market participant rationale. He argued that Kentucky wasn't just passively participating in the market, they were actively using their tax policy to manipulate the market. And that goes against the fundamental purpose of the Dormant Commerce Clause. He felt the court should have taken a much stricter approach and recognized that Kentucky was overstepping its boundaries.
So we've got this clear divide here between the majority's view that states have more leeway when they're acting as market participants and the dissent's concern that this could open the door to a whole lot of economic protectionism. It makes you wonder if there were any other cases that might have influenced the court's decision in this one. Were there any precedents that helped shape their thinking?
Absolutely. The majority really leaned on a previous case called United Haulers, which dealt with waste management. In that case, the court had said it was okay for a state to favor its own publicly owned waste disposal facilities. So the question becomes, is there really a difference between garbage and bonds?
That's a fascinating comparison. It seems like the majority was trying to draw a parallel between more traditional government functions like waste management or issuing bonds and activities that are more commercial in nature, where the Dormant Commerce Clause might be applied more strictly.
Yeah.
But did the dissenters address this United Haulers case at all? Did they offer a counterargument?
They did. They argued that United Haulers was a very specific case with a unique set of facts and that it shouldn't be stretched to cover something as complex and economically significant as the bond market. Justice Kennedy in particular felt that Kentucky's tax scheme was much more explicitly designed to give an advantage to in-state interests and shield them from competition from out-of-state interests, which is exactly the kind of behavior that the Dormant Commerce Clause is supposed to prevent.
Okay, so we're seeing this back and forth over how broadly or narrowly the court should interpret the Dormant Commerce Clause. It sounds like there's plenty of room for debate here. But let's bring it back to our listeners for a moment. We've talked about the potential impact on investors, but what about the bigger picture? What are some of the broader implications of this decision for the economy as a whole?
That's a great question. This case could potentially influence how states approach a whole range of economic policies. If states feel like they have more freedom to favor their own businesses or industries, even if it means putting those in other states at a disadvantage, it could lead to a much more fragmented and less efficient national economy. Think about things like state subsidies, tax breaks for specific industries, or even regulations that are designed to give an advantage to local companies over companies from out of state.
So this case might be about bonds, but it could have ripple effects far beyond Wall Street. It makes you wonder if the court fully considered those broader economic impacts when they made their decision. Did any of the justices, either in the majority or the dissent, address those potential ripple effects?
It's interesting because the economic implications weren't really front and center in the court's opinions. The majority really focused more on the legal principles at play, the scope of the Dormant Commerce Clause, the market participant exception, and the relevance of that United Haulers case. The dissenters, while they did express some concerns about the potential for economic harm, were mainly focused on the legal arguments as well.
That's surprising. You'd think the potential economic consequences of a decision like this would be a major consideration for the court. Do you think this reflects a broader trend in how the court approaches cases that have big economic implications?
It's tough to say for sure, but it definitely raises some questions about the role of the court in regulating the economy. There's this ongoing debate about how much deference courts should give to state economic policies, even when those policies might have spillover effects on other states or even the national economy as a whole.
So this case really highlights the tension not just between states and the federal government, but also between the judicial branch and the other branches of government. It makes you wonder if there might be a better way to resolve these kinds of disputes, maybe through legislation or interstate compacts, rather than relying on the courts to figure it all out. But before we go too far down that rabbit hole, let's get back to the legal nuts and bolts of Kentucky v. Davis. We've talked about the majority and dissenting opinions, but were there any concurring opinions? Did any of the justices agree with the outcome, but maybe for different reasons?
There were actually a few concurrences in this case, each offering a slightly different take on the issue. Justice Stevens, for example, really emphasized the fact that Kentucky wasn't acting like a typical business trying to make a profit. They were trying to raise money for essential public services. He seemed to be suggesting that the Dormant Commerce Clause should be applied a little less strictly when states are engaged in what he called quintessential government functions.
So he's drawing a distinction between a state acting like a business and a state acting in its traditional role as a provider of public goods.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting nuance. What of the other concurrences? Did any other justices weigh in with unique perspectives?
Chief Justice Roberts also wrote a concurrence, and he leaned pretty heavily on that United Haulers precedent. He basically argued that the court had already established in United Haulers that states have more flexibility when they're performing these core government functions, and that Kentucky v. Davis was really just a natural extension of that principle.
Okay, so we've got a real range of opinions here, even among the justices who ultimately sided with Kentucky. It doesn't sound like there's a clear consensus on exactly how far this market participant exception should extend, or when a state's actions cross the line from being a legitimate government function to something that looks more like economic protectionism. This case really highlights the complexity and the ambiguity of the Dormant Commerce Clause. But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to touch on one more legal concept that you mentioned earlier, the Pike balancing test. Can you remind us what that test is all about and why it wasn't used in this particular case?
Sure. The Pike balancing test is basically a tool that courts can use to figure out whether a state law that seems to burden interstate commerce is still okay. It involves weighing the burdens on interstate commerce against whatever local benefits the law might provide. If the local benefits outweigh the burdens on interstate commerce, then the law is usually allowed to stand.
So it's kind of like a cost-benefit analysis for state laws. The court looks at how much a law is hurting interstate trade and weighs that against how much it's helping the state. But in Kentucky v. Davis, the majority chose not to apply this test. Why not? It seems like a pretty logical approach.
Their reasoning was that it would be just too difficult to accurately measure the costs and benefits of Kentucky's tax scheme. They basically said we're not economists and weren't really equipped to make those kinds of judgment calls about complex financial markets.
So they're basically saying they don't have the expertise to apply the Pike test in this case. That's interesting. But I can also see how the dissenting justices might take issue with that.
Exactly. The dissenting justices argued that the court was basically shirking its responsibility to protect interstate commerce by refusing to even try to apply the Pike test. They felt that the court should have at least made an attempt to assess the economic impact of Kentucky's tax scheme, even if it was a difficult and complex undertaking.
So we've got yet another area of disagreement. It seems like there are a lot of unresolved tensions in this whole area of dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. This case really brings those tensions to light.
Absolutely. Kentucky v. Davis is one of those cases that raises more questions than it answers. And that's part of what makes it so fascinating and so important to study. It forces us to grapple with these fundamental questions about the balance of power between the states and the federal government, and the role of the courts in regulating our very complex and constantly evolving economy.
All right, we've covered a lot of ground again in this segment. We've dug deep into the nuances of the majority and dissenting opinions, explored the United Haulers precedent, and even touched on that Pike balancing test. But as always, there's still more to uncover. When we come back in part three, we'll shift gears and really focus on the broader implications of Kentucky v. Davis and what this case might tell us about the future of the Dormant Commerce Clause. Welcome back to our deep dive into Department of Revenue of Kentucky v. Davis. We've really gone through the opinions, the arguments, and wrestled with some pretty complex stuff. Now I want to zoom out and look at the bigger picture. What kind of lasting impact did this decision have? And what does it tell us about the future of the Dormant Commerce Clause?
Well, one of the most immediate impacts was that a lot of other states took notice. It was like Kentucky's win kind of gave them permission to try out similar tactics.
Like it emboldened them a little.
Exactly. They started using similar tax incentives to try and attract investors to their own bonds. It really makes you wonder, did this decision end up making the bond market even more fragmented, just like the dissenting justices were worried about?
It almost sounds like Kentucky might have won the battle, but maybe at the cost of a bigger war over interstate competition. So what's actually happened in the bond market since this ruling? Have we seen a noticeable shift toward these more state-specific strategies?
It's tough to say for sure if it's all directly because of Kentucky v. Davis, but there's definitely been a trend toward states doing their own thing in the bond market.
More individual strategies.
Yeah. Some states really doubled down on those tax exemptions for their own bonds, while others have tried different approaches to make their bonds more appealing to investors. It's definitely created a more complex and nuanced landscape, for sure.
It makes you wonder if all this complexity actually benefits investors, or if it just makes things more confusing and maybe even riskier. But let's pull back even further and talk about the Dormant Commerce Clause itself. Did this case really weaken the doctrine, or did it just clarify some of its boundaries?
That's the big question, isn't it? Legal scholars are still debating that one to this day. Some argue that Kentucky v. Davis really did narrow the scope of the Dormant Commerce Clause, especially when it comes to those activities that are traditionally considered to be the role of the government.
So the thinking is that if a state can make a strong case that it's acting like a sovereign entity rather than a player in the market, it essentially gets more freedom to discriminate against interstate commerce.
Yeah.
That sounds like it could have some pretty significant implications.
Yeah. Right. And that's definitely a worry for people who believe in a strong and unified national market. But there are others who argue that this decision doesn't really change the basic analysis of the Dormant Commerce Clause. They point out that the court still acknowledged how important it is to prevent states from engaging in outright economic protectionism.
So maybe it's not a complete overhaul of the doctrine, but more of a subtle shift in the balance of power between state and federal interests.
Yeah.
It seems like this case left a lot of questions unanswered.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so fascinating and so relevant even today. Kentucky v. Davis is a reminder that the law is constantly evolving. It's shaped by new cases, interpretations, societal changes, all of that.
It's almost like the court drew a line in the sand, but then the tide keeps coming in and washing that line away. What advice would you give to our listeners, especially those who are practicing law and might be dealing with cases that touch on the Dormant Commerce Clause? How should they navigate this post-Kentucky v. Davis world?
I think it's more important now than ever to really dig into the specifics of each case. The market participant exception can be a powerful tool for states, but it's not a free pass. Lawyers need to be ready to argue about the exact nature of what the state is doing and whether it really qualifies as a traditional government function.
So it's all about the details.
Precisely. And lawyers also need to keep in mind the bigger picture, the political and economic context. The Dormant Commerce Clause isn't just some abstract legal idea. It represents our commitment to free trade and a unified national market. So any case that involves it is going to have significant consequences for how power is balanced between states and the federal government.
This has been a real deep dive in every sense of the word. We've explored Department of Revenue of Kentucky v. Davis, a case that took us from the complexities of the Dormant Commerce Clause to the dynamics of the bond market and that ongoing tug of war between state and federal power.
It's a case that reminds us that the law is a living, breathing thing. It changes over time. And as our economy keeps evolving, so too will the legal frameworks that govern it.
We hope you've enjoyed this journey with us. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, and remember, the Dormant Commerce Clause is always there, lurking in the background, shaping the contours of our national economy.